In early 2014, Steve Ingham, Director of Science at the English Institute of Sport, lectured my master's group at Loughborough University. Personally, I found that 2 hours to be among the best professional development I have ever experienced. In this interview, Steve shares some of the best bits which he's picked up from a career in elite sport which started at the 1996 Atlanta Olympics. You may have noticed that Great Britain just had their best Olympics ever, and Steve was one of the driving forces behind that. Thanks for listening to this incredible hour of advice. I hope you take as much from it as I did.
Welcome to the Well-Traveled Wellness Podcast. Maximum performance, minimum fuss. Critical wisdom and actionable insights from leading minds in the field of human performance around the globe. And now, here's your host, Jake George Schuster.
Back to the Well-Traveled Wellness Podcast. Today we're calling across the Isles of England to talk to Steve Ingham, Director of Science at the English Institute of Sport. Steve has recently self-published the book, How to Support a Champion, The Art of Applying Science to the Elite Athlete. I was guest lectured by Steve during my master's degree at Loughborough University and found him a really, really impressive speaker and a great mind, so I'm pretty excited to have you on the show today, Steve.
Good morning, good evening, Jake.
Welcome, welcome. Thanks for being here. For those who might not be too deep into the NSO setups or might not know too much about the EIS, can you tell us a bit about your background and your role with the English Institute of Sport to begin?
Yeah, my background as a physiologist as my profession. I started working full-time in applied sports physiology back in the middle of the 90s, just before the 1996 games. And I was fortunate enough to catch the wave of institutes growing up within around the world, but within Britain. So we did pretty badly at the 96 games, and that spurred us to set up the institute systems. But at the time, I started to work with our National Olympic Committee, the British Olympic Association, which is the forefather of the Institute of Sport systems. And then probably 5 or 6, maybe 7 years later, about 2002 or so, the Institute system was set up, mirrored in some ways the Australian Institute support systems. And then from 2005, I joined that organization. And coincidentally, we were awarded the games that year, which put a rocket up our system. And I think probably if I reflect back over my career, it was starting to become professional in the mid-90s by the injection of lottery and government exchequer funding, which allowed athletes to be full-time, recover well, and so on. But it wasn't really until the early 2000s that we started to pursue, I think, what we'd consider as much more progressive application of science and knowledge. Then I started to phase out my applied work with athletes from 2009, when I started to take up more formal leadership positions as head of physiology and now director of science. I still do cling to a couple of really good athletes just to make me look good, though.
One of the things that really stood out to me in your guest lecture to us at Loughborough, Steve, was that I'll let you cite the athlete that you mentioned, but you said that When you began working with an athlete who had won, I believe, 2 games at the time, and he was going for a third, and he said, you know, you trained low volume, high volume, low carb, high carb, but what's the best way to do it? What are a few things that you've learned across, you know, working quite a few Olympiads that have actually stood the test of time that you find are pretty big indicators of success or pretty big methods for success in training athletes for Olympic Games?
As a practitioner, and how you influence other people, or there's sort of nuggets of knowledge about what are the sorts of things that you might introduce to an athlete's world?
Yeah, I'd say the latter.
I think that we have a habit in in science of making things more complicated than they need to be. And if you were to tot up all of the claimed performance improvements based upon, let's say, drinking carbohydrate drinks before a football match, or taking creatine or beta alanine, or doing this type of training, then you'd actually move faster than the speed of light. I think that we overinflate a lot of the claims, primarily because we don't actually work with people, or a lot of research studies aren't actually with people with the hardware and the infrastructure, the lung capacities and the muscle fiber composition and the springs that we encounter in the very elite world. And so the extrapolation of those findings is somewhat distorted. So the biggest learning that I've probably encountered is that I must listen as a scientist to coaches and athletes to find out what they think. And it's very rare to find a coach and an athlete who hasn't spent an awful lot of time thinking about their efforts and what they do. And so if you then draw out some of the key principles of how they do prepare, then you can, I think you can take some interesting messages. For example, in endurance sports, you obviously have to train a lot, and I don't necessarily think there's a magic formula for doing that. If it helps, it probably helps at a conference of trying to show a magic formula or a magic planning session or this special type of training. But actually, a lot and varied all the time are some of the key tenets of preparing endurance athletes, for example. Should I stop there or should I keep going?
No, I think that's right. I think it's really good. I think it's, well, yeah, I'm always just interested, Steve, to speak to anyone who's kind of been there and done that through multiple Olympiads and multiple cycles, because they can see what comes and goes. And, you know, every games, there's a bunch of articles saying, oh, these athletes are, I don't want to call this one out. Well, I do, but you know, these athletes are using beetroot. You know, everyone's using beetroot at this games, and everyone's using, you know, whatever else at that games. And I think at some point enough falls by the wayside that you see what the commonalities are. So I'm just interested in that really.
Well, I mean, our biology hasn't really changed an awful lot over the last couple of hundred thousand years. And so if we draw out some of the fundamental principles that of homeostasis, for example, that you stress the organism and then you allow it to recover and you provide some optimal conditions to do that again. But it's inherently lazy and will go back to basics if you don't stimulate it again in different ways. And things like, and all this is a little bit of a hobby horse of mine, things like ice baths or use of anti-inflammatory steroidal drugs, they're quite trendy, but now they're starting to realize actually, oh, maybe the evidence isn't as strong, or they were so acute that we didn't think about the long-term picture of trying to prepare an athlete for their ultimate performance. So you can't really trick the biology that hard. Whereas something like beetroot is interesting because it's starting to open up blood vessels. And so you start thinking, okay, what's the basic principles? What am I trying to achieve here? And is that helping the long-term goal? And if it can pass some of those simple, very subtle tests, then I think we should be able to test it, review the idea, maybe have a look at how it might apply in the off season, and then try it in some low key competitions, and then maybe launch it if we think it could be an innovation.
That makes sense. One thing I really found that I've come around on, Steve, over the last few years as a practitioner is that, and I know it's so cliche to say, but it's that there's no be all end all, and there's no panacea. You know, that people get really excited. They like to get excited about stuff, but everything is just a tool. Everything is, it has its place, and nothing should draw the manpower or attention of a whole staff, you know, just because it's got a couple papers published about it.
Oh, I totally agree. And Everything is a tool, if necessary, for the circumstances, the very special context and situation, the upbringing, the genetics that that athlete in that moment in time, and that stage of their maturation encounters. And we're quite guilty as scientists of having a tool and wandering around with this hammer looking as if everything looks like a nail. And rather than thinking, I don't need the hammer today, I'll put my hammer down. And it's a real shame to see, actually, that people don't have the breadth or the magnanimity to think, actually, you know what, I think you need someone else or some other knowledge that I don't have, or maybe I should go and get it.
Yeah, yeah. Now, one of the things that I think that is really cool about an Olympic Games, of the many things, is you get a million different trainers, or well, a few thousand, I guess, different trainers and different support staffs using so many different methods to prepare so many different types of athletes, and they're all in the same village together. Can you tell us a bit about what it was like to be part of a host nation for an Olympic Games and some things that you observed?
It was incredible. I mean, it's 4 years to the day, actually, of the anniversary of the opening ceremony, 27th of July. And, it was unique in the sense that it was enormously pride giving for our nation. And although I do wonder whether most people looked and thought, what was that about? It was strange in many ways, but it was so uplifting to see our nation completely change on a sixpence, as almost nearly every nation goes through hosting the Games, where it's 4 to 7 years of cynicism and then suddenly a celebration of sport, humanity, and endeavor. And we saw people changing their behaviors on the underground, actually talking to each other and smiling in the streets of London. I mean, who would have thought it? But it was also strange, the fact that, for example, I live in the Midlands. I'm 2 hours away from London. We could buzz down and watch the Olympics and go home for the night. Or if a coach has forgotten something, they could just phone up and say, could you go come and get this for me, or come and help me? Whereas in Macau or in Beijing or in the Gold Coast and Sydney or in Athens, or my colleagues now over in Belo Horizonte or Rio, they have to prepare very differently for an away games and encounter very different cultures in their preparation lead up. But it was truly wonderful, an honor to experience. Perhaps one of the unique experiences that we've had over the last 4 years, which we perhaps didn't anticipate, because you always have a lull after a games where everyone's very excited, see the performances, win, lose or draw, and they go home and they're in this some sort of stress disorder almost post games. What we encountered was a second wave of that, of 200 to 300 staff thinking, is it ever going to get better than that? Third place on the table, beating the Russians, which, if you look at what's in the press, is quite remarkable, because we've done it morally and ethically well. Then, what's that all about? Okay, so Rio, that will be an interesting challenge. And so we've got to galvanize our own leadership, galvanize the team behind a different prospect of sustaining success, which doesn't sound as groovy, but is something that no one's really ever done before, of continuing post home games and setting the pace, I think, for the global institute type race of saying, actually, we're going to change, we're going to adapt, we're going to move up to the next level. So that's been an interesting challenge that we perhaps didn't anticipate.
Yeah, it's funny. I remember, I believe it was Nick Diaper was lecturing us in the same module, Steve, and he said that a lot of people didn't realize that actually the medal count from Beijing was so obscenely high that the pressure put on for London was just incredible. And therefore, to kick on from that, and, you know, if I remember right, that the medal count was just a hair lower in London than Beijing, but, you know, with the iconic ones like, you know, Murray and Jess Ennis and a million other names, Mo Farah, having such success that the games became so iconic, But then to have to kick on and just have the same standard again 4 years later is some pretty incredible pressure.
Well, that was true for the Paralympics, actually, and probably the Paras got caught out, that a number of nations moved up by the time it came around to 2012. For London, compared with Beijing at the Olympics, we went from 47 medals in Beijing to 65 medals in London. We set the goal of fourth place for the 2012 Games. And we achieved that in Beijing. And the government then looked around and said, okay, what are you going to do now? And third place is populated by some nations with a serious population. and 200 to 300 plus thousand, sorry, million. And a couple with a billion. So it's a rare place to be. We had to go again. But I think we were developing such momentum into Beijing that actually it was carry over towards London. And I think there'll be an element of that where the medal count will be high for Britain now, come the Games. Maybe not as high as London, which for a home Games, to match a home Games performance is, I would imagine, impossible. But the sands are shifting in the Olympic world. And so it could be possible. It's not probable, but to go again, maybe the next games, Tokyo again, to keep moving the away games record forward. That is unique. That is something that no one's ever done before again.
That's right, and I think the many rumblings and the much smoke that we see, with WADA and IOC right now, not an area we have to get into, but the many rumblings we see now, I think. If they keep that smoke from turning into real fire before Rio, they won't for the next 4 years. You know, things are going to have to change, I think, before Tokyo.
Yeah, I would almost certainly think they would. I think the global response is something that the IOC will have to listen to. The IOC has led the way recently in governance and probably didn't move as assertively as most people would have liked, yeah.
Indeed, indeed. So you came into the scene in 96, helped host a home games in 2012, settled into this role at the EIS, and then said, I think I want to write a book. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I don't know why I started it actually, but I think it'd been bubbling for a while. I'd had a few surges of frustration mainly. With an industry that we don't have a high number of quality practitioners at interview. That's the bit where I've got my head in my hands after a full day of interviewing people. And I think, why aren't people equipped to do a job? And it's just so frustrating. Now, I can paint a sepia-toned image of me frolicking around in the labs in the early 90s and plying my trade. And I definitely had an edge in terms of getting off my bum and trying to learn how this knowledge could apply to a real person. I did that bit, which I don't see as common these days. However, I think that academia has drifted in a totally different direction to the needs of impactful applied practice. And I think that's true, not least of sport, but of exercise. And I think it's true of a lot of the sciences too. So people learn stuff. They know stuff. They don't know how to use it. They can't actually do it. And we're talking about basic human functions of being able to talk to people with confidence about their chosen topic of specialism. So that spurred me to start writing, letting off steam, a cathartic tapping of keys in several blogs. And then And I did, I tried to take a tack of being able to inspire people rather than say, you're not good enough. And you're all rubbish and all you academics don't teach the right things, because we're actually a really small sector. High performance sport is a very small, voice, and we don't employ that many people, even though we've got several hundred, scientists in our world. I don't want to point the finger of blame at other people. I want to be able to show people and say, you actually, you can do it. If you've got, sound intellect, and if you've got basic intuition for interpersonal skill, and you've got a passion of working with others and want to make a difference in this world, then you can do it too. And I absolutely adhere to that, that if you've got the basic components, that we have been able to teach that over the years about how you can influence these unique freaks, that we call elite athletes. So then I thought, well, actually, I think maybe I'll try and write something that's got a little bit more of a legacy to it. What I've noticed over the years is when I speak to audiences or to people is that I can talk about some of the stuff that I've researched and the conclusions that I've made from that paper. But I get a little twinkling in people's eyes, or people seem to light up more so when I tell stories, when I tell them about the instances that I've been in, when I've thought, ooh, I'm not sure how to work here, or actually I've got an idea that I might come to life and it's had an influence on somebody. And so rather than writing something stuffy, I wanted to write something that I enjoyed producing and hopefully that will people enjoy reading, that can give, first of all, some inspiration. It's intuitive because people can understand the intensity of the situations, and then maybe people can empathize with it to think, oh, actually, you know what? I've been in those situations, or I can imagine that situation happening and I can imagine myself in it. And I wonder how I would get on. And for it to have a little bit of instruction and support. So if somebody has the get up and go to say, well, I can do this too, then there's a little bit of support there to say, here's some first pointers that you can take in this particular area. And I've written it with 18 key themes, that hopefully it will talk to not only your aspiring applied scientist, but also people that have been there and done it and have got a little bit stuck in a rut because they haven't quite cracked a certain behavior. And also I've had more and more people contacting me from business to say, oh, these things about trust and influence and team working, these are just as important in our world. How have you developed those in other people? So I've been humbled by the response, actually. And it feels like a bit like my third child that I've let out into the world, but it's the third child that other people get to look at and wonder whether they like it or not. And they've let me know. And that's been cool too.
Well, I think that you stumbled, Steve, on a bridge, which we've all been kind of waiting to walk across between the leadership and philosophy and, you know, dare I say, self-development world and the actual, you know, sports science world. And it's funny, I was down visiting the Hurricanes of Super Rugby a couple of weeks ago in Wellington, and there had S&C Davy Gray, is a fantastic operator, world class. And we were just kind of comparing, you know, what books are you reading lately? And understandably, he's reading all leadership and, you know, anti-fragility and, always a black box, something, you know, about marginal gains and all these different things about leadership styles and communication styles. And I'm saying this stuff is all phenomenally useful for CEOs, and there's a lot for us to draw from, a lot. But no one's really written about our field and how to apply these things. So it's pretty exciting that you've put this book out. Were there any specific, obviously you've put kind of the sum of your own experiences and philosophies into this book, Steve, but were there any kind of underlying methods or philosophies that you subscribe to, whether that's kind of agile communication methods or, stoicism or anything like that?
Well, I like several, but it's somewhat similar to the sort of tests that I would apply to knowledge about, you know, as we've talked about, what type of training an athlete might do, or what type of intervention or prescription could we put in place. It has to pass a number of fundamental tests. Or is it just repackaging the same old crap into a snappy little term? I've got quite an intolerance of that. But things like, you know, like Scrum, you mentioned, and Anti-Fragile, that, you know, they basically sound good. And what I've read about them, having bursts of team activity, to nudge, something on, I relate to that. And I, some of the headiest days, some of the most enjoyable days in work are when we're just pulling something apart and innovating. And then we go off and then we reflect and then we come back together. And to give it a term like Scrum, that's absolutely fine by me, because it makes sense. In the same way that Stoicism, about choosing which thoughts you want to listen to, I buy into that, because we all have doubts. We all have this secret voice in our head that's telling us we can't do it. And those are hurdles to your own progression. And so if it's about your personal performance, it has to have it has to speak to your values. It has to speak to some sense and an active life of you moving forward. My probably the biggest philosophy that I've learned over the last 10 years or so is the well-being piece. How content you are, how balanced you are. And I see a system in the UK, for example, that is becoming more and more pressured. And I would no doubt imagine that that's replicated around the world, where people are looking for these marginal gains and turning all these stones over and KPIing everything to death. And yet, if I look back at my career and I think about the moments when I've had a real moment of realization, it's been working with people, or it's been out on a bike, or when I've been at peace and I've had an idea and it spurred me to go on and do something new and something different. And so I don't think that we should be working more and more, and we should be seeking more and more balance. I've stumbled across a term recently that I like. It's called eudaimonia, and it's an Aristotelian term about happiness as a result of an active life. It's about flourishing. And if there's one thing I'm committed to and passionate about, it's helping people be more effective, better at their pursuit, but enjoying themselves. Because I've seen too many people break down under the pressure of our strange world. And I don't think that's right. So that's my latest philosophy that really speaks to my core. It has to speak to my core, and my core values. And then it makes it in. I like a lot of the leadership philosophies. I don't always take them on completely. I might cherry pick a few elements. It has to be values based for me.
Well, it's interesting that the way you say that. So it's almost like the way that you explain it, Steve. I almost see kind of three tiers or three evolutions, one is the one I want to ask you about next, which is, you know, you're starting off in the field and there's this kind of mountain to climb and this whole skill set that we need outside of what academia delivers us and how we achieve that. And then there's, once we're in the field, it sounds like, you know, looking after your own well-being is so important and so often overlooked, and allowing yourself to flourish and all that. And then kind of almost the tertiary thing is not getting stuck in a rut and continuing to develop and learn and keep up with the Joneses, so to speak. Can we reverse engineer that process a bit? And I'd love to ask you about, you had a pretty explosive blog post about all the kind of new entrants to sports science degrees last year and saying, you know, how will you stand out from the crowd? Can you give us some thoughts just on the supply and demand in our field and kind of maybe some advice to young practitioners on how they can build their skill sets to actually succeed?
Yeah, well, I mean, just to bridge from that previous thought, I think if I was writing the perfect course for an applied sports scientist, then it would probably have quite little sports science content in it. There would be quite a lot of breadth, but there would be an awful lot of personal development, because some of the things I learned at university, some of the rocks that I put in my glass, they're still there about how we respond under stress and load, for example. But it would be much more about, are you going to continue to learn, question, and adapt yourself over the next 60 years? Are you going to continue to do that? That would be the challenge, I think, that I would lay down in a degree course of some sort, or some sort of development opportunity. But I think for somebody who, that's in the UK, they have to pay £9,000 a year for a degree course. I think there's a little bit of, they want to be spoon-fed. They think they're paying customer, they're going in and they want something that's custom fit and designer and specifically for them, but they're actually getting something pretty off the shelf and not really what they want or what they need. That's the reality of it. Without sounding too harsh on my academic colleagues, often they design modules and courses on the stuff they're interested in researching. So you have these warped courses on, I don't know, earlobe structure. Let me be sarcastic. And there is a whole module on it because I've got funding from the Earlobe Council, and that's what they're teaching. So first bit of advice for aspiring sports scientists would be, don't accept that as your agenda to learn. That shouldn't be your only curricula. You obviously need to pass the tests that they put in place and have to get pretty savvy about how you get the best marks to represent yourself. But there's probably enough time for you to wander off and start following your nose. I started to read a lot about the origins of human evolution when I was at university, and I just followed it, and it's been a lifelong passion now. And I wish I'd done more of around psychology, because everything I do now is about influencing, encouraging changes in human behavior. There's a couple of things that I did that I don't see enough of. And this is a little bit, this might be just my version of the world, but I really valued getting together with a couple of people and saying, what do you think about this? Have you got these same questions that I've got? I don't understand this bit. How have you explained this before? And not only did it allow me to accelerate my understanding, but it also accelerated my communication. Because when I understood something and it made sense to me, then I was able to communicate it. And that's not difficult. You should be living and breathing with other students to get together. We could call it sports science scrum downs, couldn't we? We could coin a new term. And from that, then go and find ways of making it stick to your head. Finding a metaphor, going a trying beasting your hamstrings after you've learned about hamstrings, or running up hills when you've learned about maximum heart rate, making it stick to you, and then trying to find ways in which you can apply it to a real world population. And you might need to read the disclaimer at the bottom of Jake's screen about about getting insurance, but that's something that I think is invaluable, because you'll get pushback about how you've acted, what you've said, and that's clean, golden feedback about how effective you are. And at that point, you might give up and quit the course, or you might go home crying, or you might think, no, actually, I've had a, I'm never going to do this ever again. But if you've got the resilience to go back and say, I've repackaged my idea and I think I can help, going out there into the big bad world and trying to make your knowledge come to life is not only probably the biggest challenge that I think, sports science students have, but I think it offers the most valuable reward. I had the honor of being a post cardiac rehabilitation fitness trainer when I had just graduated. And some of the comments that people made 6 months after the work that I'd put on, I value just as much as seeing athletes that I've worked with stand on top of an Olympic podium. And if you can make a difference in this world, then ultimately that's got to be our purpose, rather than just creating knowledge and burying it in a journal that for no one ever to read again. That can't be the only thing. I got a little bit flippant there.
No, I really like that. I really like that, Steve, because I'll tell you, I think I wish someone really hammered home to me more, especially even during my undergrad days. I was pretty busy playing sport myself, but just saying, like, you know, you got to go out and you got to coach. And you know, and I did, and most of us do. But I mean, I think we, in working with athletes, we've got to make several thousand mistakes before we can be really good at what we're doing.
Yeah.
And so you might as well get the first few hundred of them out of the way ASAP.
Yeah, I think you can fast track it, but through tools such as reflective practice and having a strong and empowering mentor, if you can find those, then that will definitely help. But there are ways in which you have to get past that hurdle of trial and error until you start to hit your rhythm. Yeah, I think that's very true, and not least because you're unlikely to find two athletes or two clients, whatever your world, you're unlikely to find two that are exactly the same. So you'll always be problem solving. You'll always be dealing with complexity and shifting sands. So you have to be sound in what you truly believe and what you think is effective.
Where is the sports performance field headed? So that's what I want to ask you. And I think this book indicates a little bit, and your blogs indicate a little bit, especially about the supply and demand in the field and so on and so forth, and the way academia, I think, is evolving a little bit. But, you know, you hear some people saying we're coming into an age of chronic consultancy, and staffs will grow, but then they'll shrink again, and expertise is gonna become more valued and more isolated. What's our field going to look like in 10 or 20 years?
Well, I think there are a couple of observations that we can make from the UK. And I don't know whether it's true across the globe. And so I'll give you a couple of examples. So over the last 15 years or so, performance analysis, strength and conditioning, and to a certain degree, nutrition has had a real boom in this world. We've been subjected to quite open economics, so sports buy into us or not, but that requires them to understand it fully, and that's not always the case in absolute terms. So a coach and a performance director will understand, my athletes are broke, I need a physio. I don't know much about strength and conditioning, or I need to see a doctor, I need a few of those. They don't understand necessarily as much or as extensively about biomechanics and movement patterns. So they don't buy it. They don't get it. So presentation of science is, I think, the bit that could make a real big difference to some massive gains. Forget the marginal gains. If we can make biomechanics sticky, for example, I think that that would be far more impactful than as hitting the same areas in physiology. And on a similar note, I think there's the area of skill and learning that's untapped, and the progression of technique that doesn't seem to be as strong a field. And possibly, I think it's because there's no good professional title for it. I'm serious. It's a bit glib, but if someone said I'm a skill acquisition learning officer, and I just don't know whether that's going to be a compelling job title for somebody. Whereas if you say something, I'm a strength trainer, you're like, oh, cool. So I think there's areas around that. Technology is probably untapped in sport. We do it quite well in Britain, but we don't do it well globally. But I'm fearful. I say fearful. I'd slightly provocatively, and a bit of a challenge to the world, really, is that I'm fearful if people start cottoning on to quality application of what we already know, and influencing coaches and athletes, Britain will get left for dust. I go and visit some countries, and I sit there and just think, you are wasting that talent. You are not going to the places that is necessary to move that person forward. And that's definitely something I think that we're attacking in Britain. And that could be, for example, that I might have a stroppy day. I might have a bad attitude one day, and someone will cite me on it, and someone will say, that wasn't good enough today, or your analysis wasn't good enough, and they'll call me on it. I spoke to some colleagues from the Japanese Institute, and they said, you've got 20 different centers across the UK. How do you get to work with each other? How do you collaborate with each other? And I talked about developing trust and virtual networks and forums to meet. And they said they have a challenge of being in the same building, but nobody talks to each other. That's just massively untapped potential. So I think that we can talk about futurology all we like, but the best signals are the ones that are right in front of us today that give us clues as to what our next steps should be. I actually don't buy into the futurology mystical types that feel that they can predict based on social media or behavioral analysis or analytics of what we're going to do in 5 to 10 years. I genuinely don't think that. Well, if someone can show me that they've been able to predict something 5 to 10 years hence, I might be convinced. Something that's really tangible. I think we should live in the now and maximize the now so that we can, with real clarity, decide what the next steps tomorrow will be.
Yeah, fair enough, Steve. I think that's a great answer. And I think if there's one thing we can predict, which I think you just did, really, is that not having a growth mindset will no longer fly in this industry. I mean, we see the just incredible success of someone like Eddie Jones, and just see head coaches are going to have to work really closely with the performance staff, and they're going to have to really adapt their leadership styles and their communication styles to, dare I say, join the 21st century.
Oh, yeah. Well, I wouldn't disagree with that. I think if we're looking for the next big breakthrough in fields of exploration, then that's difficult to crack. But if we're talking about continual pursuit and refinement of the fundamentals of effective relationships and exploring new boundaries, then that's going to stay.
Final question for you, Steve. I like to finish on like kind of a top three list. Sometimes it's, you know, three elements of a high performance culture or something like that. But we've talked a lot about those areas already today. What I'd like to ask you is, for someone who's already in the field, has got a couple degrees under their belt, is probably in a job, has a decent network, what are your three best pieces of advice for continuing to grow and develop into a world-class practitioner?
Well, these would be mine, and I wouldn't necessarily want to impose them on other people for them to copy, because they, because I think somebody's values would speak to them and their authentic identity. So my first one, I'm thinking of these off the top of my head quickly because I wasn't expecting this. My first one would be that you've got to know yourself. And that's quite deep, but ultimately you've got to spend your life with you, and that you will have ups and downs along the way. You will get people telling you that you can't do it, or you shouldn't do it, or your idea's rubbish, or you were no good today. And you've got to know how you work, what makes you tick, what's your personal preferences, and so that's the start point, I think, of all personal journeys, that you've got to know yourself. And until you get to that point, then you're probably only going to be in first gear. The second would be about surrounding yourself with people that truly inspire you. That the points where I've just thought, actually, you know what, I'm going to move on. I've had enough. Have been based because somebody has rotted my brain or drained my energy. And that might not necessarily be the people that you have to work with necessarily, because you don't always, you know, the gold medalists or champions aren't always lovely. So it's surrounding yourself with people that genuinely make you feel good and inspire you and show you that you can do better. And I think probably the final one would be to do stuff that gives you excitement. So fill your life full of stuff that makes you just spring out of the bed in the morning. And we're in a privileged, purposeful environment all the time. But that would be my final ones.
Steve Ingham, author of How to Support a Champion, The Art of Applying Science to the Elite Athlete, and Director of Science for the English Institute of Sport. Thank you so much for your time today.
You're very welcome. Thanks for the chat, Jake. It's been very cathartic.
Thanks for listening to today's episode. Check in soon for an interview with Dr. Jeremy Shepherd and with Jamie Tout of VX Sport. If you leave a review of this podcast on iTunes, you'll get a free hour of coaching with me and a big high five. Thanks for listening. We'll see you soon.
To learn more about how you can achieve maximum performance with minimum fuss, sign up to our free newsletter at welltraveledwellness.com. You'll get actionable insights from real people on how they manage their days to lead ultra-healthy and productive lifestyles. Sign up today at welltraveledwellness.com.